Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, American, European and RCVS specialist in small animal surgery, Pilar Lafuente. Thank you, Pilar. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Emer, and thank you very much, everyone, for being here today for this webinar. Today, I'm going to speak about external skeletal fixators, especially postoperative management and care, and the most common complications that we may find when we are dealing with external skeletal fixators. So the main objectives of this webinar is for you to get familiar with the postoperative management of external skeletal fixators and also to be able to recognize and treat the most common complications. Obviously, every patient is different, but at least I'm going to give you some clues about what to do depending on the complication that you may encounter. So the webinar is going to be divided in different aspects of external skeletal fixators. First, I will just talk a little bit about basic concepts in when we use external skeletal fixator. Then I will go through the postoperative management of external skeletal fixator, and then we'll talk about complications. I have divided the complications into those that are related to pin tract infection, that are related to the fixator. They can also be bone complications when we use an external skeletal fixator, or soft tissue related, especially impalement. So just to start a little bit with some basic concepts. So obviously in orthopedics, every single implant that we place to stabilize a fracture is subjected to fatigue. So obviously what we want is for the fracture to heal so that the implants receive less and less forces. Otherwise, with time, they will suffer this cyclic fatigue and eventually will fail. So we obviously want the bone to heal. In general, it is recommended for the implants to be placed in the tension surface of the bone because they are more resistant to the forces rather than being placed in the compression side of the bone. In general, implants are weaker against bending than other forces that apply to the bone, like axial compression or rotation. And this is especially important when we are in front of a comminuted fracture, especially if the transcortex or the cortex, for example, here in the compression side of the bone, if it's not reconstructed, the bone is going to tend to collapse medially and our implant is going to be laterally and it may fail the implant. Although it is in the side, in the tension side of the bone, if this the compression side of the bone is not reconstructed, it's going to tend to collapse, and as I was saying, and then the implant is going to be submitted to really great forces. And then we need to have in mind about having a balance between the force that the bone receives and stress protection. So if there's too much force, or the force that the implant actually receives. So if the bone receives too much force, and the implant, it may fail. But if the bone doesn't receive enough force, obviously the implant is not gonna fail, but the bone is not gonna heal. The bone needs to receive some forces to have remodeling of the bone, and that's what we call stress protection. If we have an implant that is very, very rigid, then the bone is not gonna receive any force, and is not gonna remodel, and is not gonna heal. So what are the indications of external fixation? So external fixation, we frequently use it for fracture stabilization, but it has many other indications or applications actually. It can be used to correct angular limb deformities, especially if we use circular frames that we will see shortly. It can be used also for bone lengthening, like you can see here in this photo. It's not a very common procedure, but in some instances, if the bone is too short and is causing clinical signs, we may need to increase the length of the bone, and usually this is done with external skeletal fixators. We can also use ESF frames to immobilize temporarily a joint. For example, when we have a suture tendon, you can see in this photo, for example, the patella tendon. If we have repaired the tendon, we need to. It's very important that we immobilize the joint so that the tendon can heal appropriately. So most of the time we do it with a transarticular external fixator. In this case, as I was saying, this was to treat an injury to the patella tendon, so we place an external, a transarticular external fixator in the femur and the tibia. But you know, if we had a rupture, an injury in the common calcaneal tendon, we would place this transarticular external fixator in the tibia and the metatarsal bones. External skeletal fixators can only be can also be used to perform arthrodesis of a joint. I personally don't like using external fixators because you cannot apply compression, and we will see that they have high risk of having complications, especially pin tract infections. So in general, with arthrodesis, we need a stabilization method that will last for a long time, because an arthrodesis may take a few months to heal. So I prefer, and I think most surgeons prefer, to use internal fixation like a plate. But it can be used in some circumstances. So just briefly, there are different types of external skeletal fixators. We have linear ESFs, like we have here in these photos. Mainly the pins are placed in planes. So for example, we have the type 1A, where the pins are coming from one side. They are crossing both cortices, but they are connected to the connecting bar just in one side. Then we have type 1B, which is kind of like two types 1A in a 60 to 90 degree angle between them. Then we have the type 2A, which is a frame where the pins cross from one side to the other and they are connected with connecting bars in both sides of the leg. A modification of these external fixators, the type 2B, where you can see that some of the pins are just connected to one of the connecting bars. So this will be type 2B or type 2 modified ESF. And then the type 3 in this case is biplanar and bilateral, because we have one plane, like a type 2 external fixator plus a type 1A external fixator. So the combination is a type 3. They are coming, there's one plane in this direction, and then another plane of external fixator in a 60 to 90 degree angle to the previous fixator. Circular external fixator, they use rings and connecting bars and K-wires. In this case, when we use a circular external fixator, the pins are not really pins, they are K-wire. They are smaller in size, so they are allowed to put the K-wires really close one to the other, as you can see here. And that using these small K-wires allow some micro-motion to the construct, which has been proven to stimulate bone healing. So there are different types of rings. They are open, closed, different sizes. But these are circular external fixators. Then we have hybrid ESFs, which are a combination of the previous two, like in this photo. Distally, we have a circular a ring from a circular ESF, but then the rest of the bone is using a linear external fixator. Usually, these hybrid external fixators are used when we have fractures that are very close to the joint, or like in this case, when we have fractures in the femur. The femur or the humerus, we cannot place, for example, a type 2 external fixators because we have the inguinal area here, or the axilla, and the body of the dog, so we cannot really place a connecting bar medial to the bone. And then finally, we have the free-forming ESFs, which in this case, instead of using connecting bars and clamps, they use these epoxy putty or PMMA to connect all the pins. So they are quite versatile because you can put the pins in a slightly different plane, but they can be connected with this epoxy putty. But the problem is that once the epoxy putty is hard, it cannot be readjusted and actually is radio opaque, so it can interfere with the visualization of the fracture, as you can see here. Just very briefly, some basic concepts on how to apply the external fixators. You probably know that there is a minimum number of pins that we need to place, and that minimum number is 2 pins per fragment. Ideally, we should put 3 or 4. More than 4 are actually not necessary because they don't increase the biomechanical properties of the external fixator. So usually between 3 and 4 per fragment is good. Then the construction, we usually recommend a construction that is far near to the fracture. So one of the pin is far from the fracture site, another one near the fracture site, another one near to the fracture site, and another one far from the fracture site, and then we fill in between the pins. If we use all the pins very close to the fracture site, that will create stress riser proximally here, and it could fracture the bone. If the pins, for example, were all positioned quite far from the fracture site, then that will increase the instability of the fracture. So this construction, far, near, far, is the recommended one, the most stable one for the management of fractures. So in general, it is recommended not to put all the pins in the same with the same angle, because if they get loose, then the frame can move from one side to the other. If you use threaded pins, the risk of having or loosening of the pins is lower. But if you don't use threaded pins and you use smooth pins, then I would recommend that at least one of the pins is at a different angle from the other, so around 70 degrees. The pin size is another factor that we need to be careful with. The size of the pin should be around 30% of the diameter or the width of the bone, actually. If they are smaller, they can break. If they are bigger, they can actually cause a fracture in the bone. So around 30% of the width of the bone is adequate. Then the length of the pin, what I mean is the distance between the bone and the clamp. So it should be as short as possible, but allowing for some space between the skin and the clamp, so we allow a little bit of inflammation from the soft tissues, otherwise the clamp will become embedded in the soft tissues. So the closer the clamp, the better, again, with some space in between the clamp and the skin. And then we always need to be very careful to do a pre-drilling to prevent thermonecrosis of the bone, use a low speed when we apply the pins, and sometimes we need to perform releasing incisions if the incision where we place the pin is it's under a little bit of tension, so we may need to make it a little bit longer. So in general, even frequently, we apply an external skeletal fixator when we do a close reduction of a fracture. So even if it's a close reduction and stabilization of a fracture, we need to use a septic technique, okay? And I will recommend to do it under general anesthesia. It's a painful procedure, reducing a fracture and placing pins. Even if it's a close reduction and stabilization, it needs to be done under general anesthesia. Very important to use an appropriate technique, so appropriate size of the pins and the configuration of the frame. Also, adequate placement of the pins. As I was saying, I would recommend you to do a pre-drilling before placing with a drill bit before placing the pin. And then obviously we need to take post-operative radiographs to evaluate the correct placement of the implants and correct reduction of the fracture. So in general, when we have an increased inflammation around the frame, that is going to increase the patient morbidity. So we have 4 goals when we are dealing with external skeletal fixator. So first, we should try to keep to a minimum the number of microorganisms populating the pin tract infection, and I will discuss about that. So I would recommend you to clean around the pins daily, or the owners actually recommend this to the owners. Also, we should aim to decrease loosening and motion of the fixator pin, so that obviously involves an adequate placement or technique for placement of the pins, pre-drilling, etc. That's going to decrease the thermonecrosis of the bone around the pins, and is going to delay the loosening of the pins. Also, we should aim at reducing the motion of soft tissues around the pin. So we should try to aim and place the pins not through big muscle bellies, but in between muscles, so that there's less movement of the muscle around the pin. That's going to increase the more muscle we have, or the more soft tissue we have around a pin, the more inflammation we are going to have, the more discharge, and a higher risk of having a pin tract infection. So we should aim at reducing the number or the volume of soft tissue around the pins and the motion. And then, very important, we should allow to drain any fluid associated with the pin tract, which usually does, but we need to try to prevent the formation of abscesses. So for the postoperative management, I will recommend you to place a bandage immediately after surgery. This is to apply a little bit of pressure to decrease the inflammation, to improve the comfort of the patient, also to absorb some discharge fluid that we are going to have normally after placement of an ESF, and also to protect wounds if you have done an open reduction. So usually I place a soft padded bandage for around 2 to 5 days, depending on how it goes. The first layer is an absorbent layer, like an alevin, for example, like this one. I make cuts, so I pass the alevin just under the external fixator around the pin, so it covers the pins and the incision, if there is an incision in between. And then I applied a layer of either sterile gauze or sponges, the sponges that we used to use to scrub ourselves, like the surgeon, and now we don't use that system, so we use a sterile gauze. But if you still use this system, the sponge system for scrubbing of the surgical personnel, you can clean them, sterilize them, and use them. So I used to make some cuts so that they were placed on top of the or around the pins, and the main purpose of applying these sponges is to apply some pressure and decrease the inflammation. And then once we have these two layers, then I will apply a normal bandage, a padded bandage, covering the toes. So this is how it will look. Okay, this is a really big external fixator. As you can see here, it was a comminuted open fracture, so we had to put a type 3 external skeletal fixator, so that's why the bandage looks pretty good. But it should look similar to this, so the three layers and then covering the toes. So after 24 hours, I change the bandage. I explore how the limb looks, if the toes are swollen or not, or if the limb is swollen. If there's no significant swelling, then I remove the sponges and I place another bandage, just a padded bandage, leaving the toes open if they are not swollen. And then 24 hours later, I remove this bandage, and if everything looks good, if there's not too much inflammation, then I just leave it open. This is the typical way that I send my patients home. So I usually protect the clamps and the connecting bars with a little bit of cotton and the bed wrap, so that because they frequently hit furniture and, you know, the clients and everything with the external fixator. So to prevent injury to the clients and the furniture in the house, and also to decrease injury to the external fixator, or damage to the external fixator and the fracture, I usually pad a little bit the clamps. In summer, sometimes if it's really hot, I place this is kind of like a cloth bag with two openings, just with a rubber band here. It's just to protect the pins, around the pins, because they are going to have some normal discharge. And in summer, if it's really hot, or if the dog is left outside of the house, they can have, you know, flies deposit eggs and things like that. So at least this cloth cover will prevent the insects and bugs to go into the area of the pins. And then The second point in the postoperative management of external fixator is the cleaning around the pins. There's no agreement between surgeons, but I usually recommend cleaning the pin skin interface with a little bit of chlorhexidine. Some surgeons apply antibiotic ointment. I don't. I don't think it's necessary, and actually I don't give postoperative antibiotics unless it's an open fracture. And I usually clean until there's granulation tissue around the pins, so there's decreased risk of infection. Very important that when we send these patients home, we send them with a report with instructions of what the owners need to do. They need to check the frames daily to see if there's any bend or broken pins, if there's deformity of the external fixator, if there's excessive purulent discharge, and obviously evaluation of how the dog is doing clinically. If the dog was doing well and suddenly is not using the leg and is very swollen, it means that it may be a problem. And then I usually recommend them to go maybe every couple of weeks or something like that to the vet so that they can just inspect how everything looks and if needed to tighten the clamps, especially if it's a puppy, they tend to be a little bit more active and they can actually loosen the clamps like we can see here in these radiographs. I'll talk about this a little bit later. Obviously, after every orthopedic surgery, we need to do exercise restriction. The protocol depends on many factors, the bone healing potential, if it's a puppy or an older dog, the type of fracture, the type of external fixator that we've placed. But in general, I recommend short-lead walks just for toileting purposes for the first 2 weeks. And then if the dog is doing well, we can increase the length of the lead walks by 5 minutes every 2 weeks. So here we have a video of a dog just a few weeks after the surgery. I think it was when he came back for suture removal, so 2 weeks. So it's very important that they are walk slowly with the lead, but it's very important that they use the leg. This is critical because those forces that are going to go through the bone are the ones that are going to stimulate bone healing. So it's very important that they use the leg in a controlled manner. So the rest of the time they should be resting in the house or in a crate. And I usually take radiographs between 4 and 6 weeks. If it's a puppy, at around 4 weeks because they heal faster. If it's an adult dog, around 6 to 8 weeks. And then depending on how much healing we have, then I progressively increase the length of the walks, usually by 5 minutes per week, but it depends on how it looks. For cats, it will be very, very similar. So they need to be caged, rested at all times. The crate needs to be big enough for the cat to have an area with the litter box, an area to be resting, and an area with the food. And after 2 weeks, and if they are doing well, they can be left outside of the crate for supervised walks, around 5 minutes initially, and then we can increase by 5 minutes every couple of weeks. When I'm dealing with, depending on the character of the cat, and especially when I'm placing external fixators in the face, I recommend the clients to cover the inner part of the crate or in the hospital, the cage, because sometimes these cats may get the external fixators, the bars, the connecting bars, caught in between the bars, and then they get caught and they get very distressed and they can damage the repair. So in cats, I tend to recommend protecting the inner part of the crate. Maybe with something plastic, which is more transparent, but this is what we use in the hospital, while in the hospital. And then radiographs again are around 4 or 6 weeks, depending on the age of the cat, and then adjust the lead walks accordingly. Physiotherapy, very, very important after fracture management. So initially, you know, with other animals, I will apply cold packs for the first 48 to 72 hours, but with external skeletal fixator, I apply a bandage. So applying cold packs on top of the bandage is actually useless. It doesn't go through. So I remove the bandage before the animal goes home, and then I recommend the owner to apply warm packs. They need to be warm, not too hot, so that we don't burn the skin. And they should apply it over the joints, mainly for 5, 10 minutes, 2, 3 times a day. That's to warm up the relax the muscles and the joints, and warm up the muscles for the exercises that we are going to do next. Then I recommend them to do some massage of the leg, not this type of massage, but this type of massage in a proximal direction, so distal to the frame in a proximal direction, especially if there's still some edema in the paw, so that with this massage we are stimulating the absorption of the edema in the paw. And they should do that for around 5 minutes, 2, 3 times a day after the warm packing. Passive range of motion is also very important to keep the normal movement of the joints, and is done after the warm packing and the massage in all the joints of the affected leg. They should do either flexion and extension exercises with every single joint, or just bicycle movements of the whole limbs for around 5 or 10 minutes, 2, 3 times a day, or 15 to 20 repetitions. This is especially important when we are dealing with radius and ulna fracture, when we place the external fixator, because usually the restriction in the flexion of the carpus is quite marked. To try to keep the normal range of motion, we need to start the passive range of motion as soon as possible. After a few exercises of flexion and extension, the owners can just hold in flexion and extension for a few seconds in order to try to increase the range of motion of the legs. And obviously, it's essential that we educate our clients, so we need to inform them of the potential complications that we may have with that type of fracture and that type of fracture repair. That we need to make them aware of the signs of complications, so that as soon as they see a potential complication, they contact us and we catch them sooner rather than later. We also need to know the owner's expectations, if this is just a pet that is going to just be walking for a few minutes a couple of times a day, or if it's a working dog or a dog competing in agility, for example. Obviously, the expectations of the owners are difficult. Obviously, we always want the animals to go back to normal, but in a working dog, for example, it's going to be extremely important, the physiotherapy and rehabilitation after surgery, so that they go back to the level of fitness that they had before the injury. So it's important that we send them home with discharge instructions. They need to be clear and concise, and they need to again reiterate what they need to look for at home in case there's any complications, and contact us as soon as they see anything that is abnormal. The frames obviously need to be removed once the fracture is healed. So we need to take regular radiographs to see when the fracture heals. The time for the fracture to heal varies depending on the age of the dog or the cat and the type of fracture. Comminuted fractures in an older dogs and open fractures, they are going to take longer to heal, sometimes months. A simple fracture or in a puppy, they are going to take just maybe 3 or 4 weeks to heal. In general, the frame is removed when we have radiographic union of the fracture, but sometimes if we see clinical union, so we may, clinical union means that we can still see a radiolucent line where the fracture was, but there is good callus formation with continuity of at least three of the four cortices. So in those cases, the frame can be removed even if we still see a radiolucent line. The frames are removed under sedation or GA. And well, it depends if you've placed a clamps and connecting bar or epoxy putty. If you place clamps and connecting bars, they are the connecting bars and the clamps are removed. If you've placed epoxy putty, you need to cut the pins. There's no clamps to remove. You need to clean around the pins because part of the pins are going to go through the bone again. They've been outside and they are going to go through. But to decrease the amount of pin that has been outside of the leg and that is going to go through the bone when we remove it, it's important to cut the pin if we are using or if we have a type 2 external fixator, so we have a pin that is in both sides of the leg. It's important to cut the pin flush to the skin in one side, and then we'll remove the pin through the other side. I usually do it manually with a Jacob chuck, as you can see here. And then I remove it by unscrewing. Sometimes these pins are so loose that they just come out with your fingers. But sometimes you need to use the Jacob chuck. And then just monitor for any bleeding. There might be just a couple of drops of blood, which is not a big issue. But if there is more significant bleeding, then I would recommend you to place a soft bandage for 24, 48 hours just to apply some pressure and stop the bleeding. And once the animal is home, I recommend the owners to clean around the wounds, and they usually heal in just 3 or 5 days. So that was mainly for the post-operative management of external skeletal fixators. So now I wanted to talk a little bit about the complications that we may encounter when using external skeletal fixators. Obviously, nobody wants to have complications, but actually, the risk of complication with external skeletal fixators is quite high. The most common is pin tract infection, which can be treated with antibiotics, as we will see shortly. So there's not a high risk of major complications, but the morbidity is higher than with internal fixator. So as I was saying before, I have divided the complications into pin tract infection, complications related to the fixator, bone complications, so related to bone healing mainly, and then related to the soft tissues, which includes soft tissue impalement. So this is a video of a dog that actually had an open fracture in the femur due to a gunshot. And even the fracture was quite challenging to fix, but this video is just to show you that even the day after surgery, if the implant is stable and is stabilizing appropriately the fracture, the animal needs to be using the leg. They start toe touching, and then the use of the leg should improve with time. I'm saying this because one time I had a client coming for the 6 or 8 week recheck, and the dog was not using the leg at all, and she was surprised when I said, well, how come you didn't call me? And she said that she thought that the animal was not supposed to use the leg with the frame. Dogs are supposed to be using the leg if the fracture is stable, if the frame is adequate. They should start putting the weight in the next couple of days after surgery. So a pin tract infection, this is divided into minor and major infection. Really, well, the minor infection is actually the normal discharge that they usually have after placement of an external fixator. So usually the discharge is serosanguineous, is not very abundant, and there's minimal inflammation around the pins, and the animal is comfortable and is using the leg. So usually the treatment is just cleaning around the pins and allow the discharge to flow. So I put it as a minor infection, but it's the normal type of serosanguineous discharge that we are going to see when we place an external fixator. So you can see here in the photo, there's a little bit of staining in the skin around the pins. That's the dog of the video. Then we have a major infection, which is due to the invasion of the pin tract by cutaneous bacteria, usually used Staphylococcus. So what we are going to see is a purulent discharge, as you can see here around this pin, or excessive discharge that is quite thick and malodorous and persistent. This is accompanied by inflammation of the soft tissues around the area, pain when we apply pressure, and deterioration in the lameness. So usually the owners will mention that, you know, the dog is still lame or the lameness is worse, and then you need to check for those signs of increased inflammation, pain, and discharge. Depending on the chronicity of the infection, if we take radiographs, we may see just soft tissue swelling if it's quite acute. Or if it's more chronic, if it's been going on for a longer time, we may see periosteal reaction and osteolysis around the pins. So for example, here we have radiographs of a dog. This dog had a mandibular fracture and I placed an external fixator. And as you can see here, around this pin here and this pin here, we see a radiolucent line, which is actually kind of irregular. It's wider in some areas, narrow in some areas. So that's very suspicious of osteolysis around the pin secondary to pin tract infection, and actually there was an increased discharge around this pin. And this is quite common in the mandible. The pins get loose quite frequently. This is not to be confused with an artifact that we can see when we use digital radiography, which is the Uberschringer artifact. This is due to, or this happens when we have two tissues that have very different density, like, you know, the high density of the implants, of the metallic implants, against the density of the bone. There is this artifact that creates a very narrow radiolucent line around the metallic implants. This only happens if you use digital radiography. And the way to differentiate it is that usually the artifact, the radiolucent line, is really thin and very homogeneous. It's the same width along the implants, and sometimes you can even follow it, you know, outside of the bone. So what do we do if we have pin tract infections? Obviously, it's very important that the owners continue cleaning around the pins. Some people apply antibiotic ointment around the pins. What I usually do is I take a sample of the discharge around the pins. I try to go as deep in the hole, I guess, around the pin as possible, and send it for culture and sensitivity just to make sure that I don't have any resistant bacteria. And then I usually give systemic antibiotics. Another complication that we may have related to the pin is an annular sequestrum, which is necrosis or thermonecrosis around the pin related to the thermal, the increase of temperature when we are placing the pins. So it's very important that we use pre-drilling before placing the pins so that we don't increase the temperature too high and cause a necrosis of the bone around the pins. Then other complications that we may have related to the fixator is we may have loose pins. So pin tract infection, thermonecrosis, and loose pins, they all come a little bit as a pack. So usually, even if we have loose pins, they usually start with increased discharge, etc. So they come really together, the three of them. So usually we have loose pins, we are going to see an increased pain and lameness in the patients. We are going to have increased discharge. This is what I was saying. And if we take radiographs, we are going to see osteolysis around the pins. So it's very important, these pins, if they are loose, they are not doing anything, they are not providing stability, so they need to be removed. They are only causing problem. They are causing inflammation and discharge that can become infected. So they need to be removed. Depending on the stage of healing of the bone, we may, if the healing of the bone is quite advanced, we may be able to remove the pins and not, we may not need to place any more pins in other places. But if it's quite early in the recovery period, if removing that implant, that pin is gonna decrease the stability of the frame, we may need to put new pins. But that depends on every case. So, for example, this was a case. This was a puppy that actually was hit by a van, and he had fractures and luxations in three of the four limbs. So in this limb, for example, the dog had a fracture in the radius and actually instability in the elbow with an avulsion fracture of the medial collateral ligament. So I repair that fragment and stabilize the elbow, and I place a transarticular fixator that was trying to stabilize the elbow and also stabilize the fracture. So the dog came at 4 weeks, and actually at this time I could start seeing that there was osteolysis around this pin, maybe a little about this one. So this was a relatively young dog, and the fracture of the radius was actually healing quite nicely. Probably I could have removed the external fixator at that time, especially with the signs of loosening, but I was worried because the dog had 3 out of 4 legs affected, and I was worried that if I removed the external fixator too early, it could, you know, refracture. So I left it. And actually what happens is just 2 weeks later, those pins that were loose, they just came out. So this is just to explain that these pins, when they are loose, they tend to come out. And if there are a few of them loose, the frame can just come out. So obviously at this stage, I removed the frame and it felt stable. This was another case. It was a 1-year-old lab with a limb deformity. So what I did is a corrective osteotomy. I placed an external fixator. I like external fixators when I correct limb deformities. And the dog was doing very well. And the owner called me because 2 weeks later, the dog had started limping a little bit more. So I told him to come. And actually, it was very obvious that the connecting bar, I don't know if you can see here in comparison to the post-op radiographs, this clam had become loose and actually off. It was off the pin, so it was not destabilizing. The connecting bar was here. Lucky for the dog, the other connecting bar was still in place and unstable, so nothing moved. But this was just 2 weeks after surgery. I reattached the connecting bar that was loose, and the dog did fine. And finally, I was able to remove the external fixator, and the osteotomy healed, and I corrected the deformity. Other complications related to the frame that we may have are unstable configurations of the frame. So what we are going to see in our patients is lameness or deterioration of the lameness, increased discharge because the fracture is going to move, and that's going to increase the movement of the tissues around the pins. And actually, sometimes we may even feel the instability of the fracture. So it's very, very important that we plan adequately how we are going to stabilize the fracture. The correct implant size, the correct configuration of the frame, and if the fracture obviously is unstable, we need a revision surgery. So this was a dog that had this comminuted fracture in the tibia, and we placed an external fixator, as you can see here, with 3 pins proximally, 4 pins distally, and the dog went home using the leg. And 1 week later, the dog came to see me, and because of another reason. I mean, the dog was still relatively lame, and the owner was concerned that one of the connecting bars was actually impinging in the soft tissues of the tarsus. But when I was evaluating the dog, I was manipulating the leg, and I could feel that something was moving. So I took radiographs, and actually, I don't know if you can see the difference from the previous radiographs. So here is the post-op radiographs. There's good alignment of the caudal cortex of the fracture, while 1 week later there's no alignment, there's movement of the fracture. And as I was saying, when I was manipulating the leg, I could actually feel the fracture moving. So obviously this frame was unstable. So maybe it was because that pin could have been a little bit closer to the fracture, and this one maybe a little bit more. The fact is that it was moving in a craniocaudal direction, so I had to revise this frame. And what I did is apply a type 1A frame just cranially. So I transformed the type 2 external fixator into a type 3. So with these pins applied in the cranial aspect of the bone, I was preventing the bone from moving in a craniocaudal direction. The bone healed with time. There was no perfect reduction, but there was good enough contact between the proximal and the distal fragments. So the bone healed, and I was able to remove the fixator a few weeks later. This periosteal, obviously, if there's no complete reduction of the fracture, we are going to have a bigger callus, but in this case, this this reaction was a little bit farther away from the fracture site, we will see that this was osteomyelitis of the bone. We'll talk about that a little bit later. We can also have implant failure, so we may have a breakage of the pins or bending of the pins. So what we are going to see is an increased pain and especially worsening of the lameness. We may see a frame deformation, or we can see actually the broken pins and instability or manipulation. And depending on how far we are in the healing process, we may see instability in the fracture. So very important that we do an adequate preoperative planning with the implants of the correct size and the configuration, as I was saying before. The pin should be around 30% of the is actually the width of the bone, which in the projection is the diameter also actually. Depending on how far we are in the healing process of the bone, we may need to do a revision surgery. Not always. So, for example, this was a case with instability in the tarsus. So we place some screws to stabilize the tarsus and a transarticular external fixator to provide more stability. So the dog was doing well, but 2 weeks later the lameness deteriorated, and you can see here that the dog has broken every single pin in the tarsal and metatarsal area. So obviously it's too early after the surgery. The tissues still need to heal. There's still a high risk of a reluxation. So we need to do something, and we need to revise the surgery. So we placed bigger pins. For example, this is another case. This is a cat with a comminuted fracture in the supracondylar area of the humerus, with very small distal fragment to place implants. So I place an external fixator, like a hybrid type of fixator, and I could, after the surgery, I could see that this pin had been was pretty small, but I didn't have much bone to place a bigger pin. It felt stable. Unfortunately, the cat had a pretty rough recovery from anesthesia, so it started running around in the cage. And the following morning, when I was checking the bandage, I could see that the cat had bent the pin. I mean, as I was saying, this was a pretty small pin, but I didn't think I could place a bigger pin. So obviously this is very early. This is one day after surgery. So I discussed it with the owner about going to surgery and change the pin. There was the concern that I had in the first surgery, that I didn't know if I had enough space to put a bigger pin, so I needed to place a transarticular fixator. But actually the leg felt stable and the cat started using the leg, so we decided to leave it like that, which is sometimes just need to make a decision depending on the situation. And actually the cat did very well. This is 8 weeks after surgery. You can see that the fracture has healed. We can still see the bent pin, which has not broken. And actually, if you see the cat walking, see if we have the video, there was no obvious deformity in the leg. So there was no valgus or varus, there was no deformity. The cat was using the leg pretty well. As you can see here, we see the external fixator in the left leg. The leg is flexing in the correct plane, so nobody could actually see any deformities unless you took a radiograph. So this case went pretty well in spite of this complication. Also, we need to be careful with pressure cutaneous necrosis. So it's very important that we leave some space between the clamps and the skin. Otherwise, we don't let enough room for the soft tissues to swell in a little bit, and then the clamps may become embedded in the skin and cause necrosis. So I usually leave around 1 or 2 centimeters between the clamp and the skin. And then obviously, the as I was saying before, placement of postoperative bandages are going to help decreasing the inflammation and prevent this complication. The third type of complications that we may have with external skeletal fixators are osseous complication related to bone healing. So we may have delay union, and this may be because of the the type of fracture that we may have, if there's severe comminution, if the reduction of the fracture is poor, if there's a big bone defect, or if the fixation is too rigid, we may have delay union. With delay union, the bone is healing, but at a slower rate. So what do we need to do? Obviously, very important when we reduce the fracture that we obtain an adequate reduction with at least 50% contact of the fragments. If there's a bone defects that are quite big, we need to apply bone grafts. And then actually is especially in cats with tibial fracture, like these radiographs that we have here, they tend to have a delay unions and even non-unions because the fixation is too rigid, and what we are causing is a stress protection of the bone. So the fixator is too rigid, is receiving all the forces. The bone is not receiving any of the forces, so it doesn't have the stimuli to remodel and heal. And this is especially, well, relatively common in fractures of the tibia in cats. So for example, here we have a an example of a cat with a it was a comminuted fracture of the tibia. I place a type 2 external fixator, and actually it was taking a long time for the fracture to heal. It was healing, so it was a delay union, but it was taking a long time. So in those cases, we may need to do a dynamization of the frame by progressively removing some pins. So as you can see here, initially we have 4 pins proximally and 3 pins distally, and we started removing pins. And we left 3 and then 2, and then progressively with time, we are allowing some of the forces to go through the bone to stimulate bone healing. Delay union, if we don't do anything about it, it could progress into a non-union. And if there's no union, those require surgery for sure, and you need to go in, debride the edges of the bone, apply a bone graft, apply compression. So usually we treat those with internal fixation with a dynamic compression plate. We may also have iatrogenic fracture. It can happen immediately or soon after surgery. It can be because of inadequate placement of the pin. For example, if the pin is not in the center of the bone, if it's a little bit eccentric and close to the cortex, it can be a stress riser and then fracture the bone through that. Or, for example, if the pin diameter is greater than 40% of the width or the diameter of the bone, that predisposes the bone to fracture, obviously, if the animal is doing too much exercise and is putting too much forces through the repair, that the bone can fracture. So this, for example, was a patient that we did an arthrodesis of the carpus with an external fixator because of a previous arthrodesis with plates that became infected. We decided to do with an external fixator. And I'm not sure if you can see here that if we follow the cranial cortex of the radius, it finishes here and then suddenly goes there. So the bone actually fractured through the first K-wire. I think the dog jumped from the arms of the owner or something like that, and it fractured through one of the K-wires. And this requires revision surgery. So in this case, for example, we modify the external fixator into a longer one to stabilize the fracture that had happened through the first pin. We may also have osteomyelitis or infection of the bone. Usually these animals are gonna come with increased pain, inflammation in the leg, and deterioration of the lameness. Usually osteomyelitis is related to pin tract infection. It usually starts with pin tract infection. So usually we have excessive and purulent discharge. And if we take radiographs, we are going to see excessive and very aggressive periosteal reaction. And it may cause delay union of the fracture. This is the case that I was talking about before. So it's healing, but there is excessive periosteal reaction actually quite far away from the fracture site. So that's not normal for a callus. So there was osteomyelitis. So I usually take a sample with a fine needle aspirate and send it for culture and sensitivity and put the animal on systemic antibiotics. If the reason for the osteomyelitis is a sequestrum, we need to go in and remove the part the piece of bone that is dead, that is sequestered. And well, this is the sequestrum. A sequestrum is a bone fragment that is unstable, infected, avascular, and dead, and actually affects bone healing. So usually this sequestrum leads to fistula that are draining outside of the limb, and radiographically we can see that that piece of bone, usually like a fragment from a comminuted fracture, that the fragment is very sclerotic with the smooth edges. There's no signs of any reaction or trying to heal, and it's actually embedded in a radiolucid pocket. So in those cases, we need to well, be careful during surgery not to manipulate or strip any soft tissues that are attaching into different fragments in a comminuted fracture. And we need to go in and remove that fragment that is dead. Otherwise, it's not going to solve the problem, and give antibiotics. We can also have refracture of the fracture that we already repaired if we remove the external fixator too early before it's healed, or if we have a non-union and we haven't noticed, or, for example, if we have a delayed recovery of the bone strength and the owner or the dog actually overdoes, it can fracture the previous fracture. So it's very important that before we remove the fixator, we make sure that there is radiographic union, or at least clinical union, with bridging of at least three of the four cortices of the bone. And then after removing the fixator, we need to restrict the exercise for the next few weeks. So, for example, this was a cut with a humeral fracture that we repaired with a type 1 external skeletal fixator. So the cut came 6 weeks later. There's not a lot going on. It's only 6 weeks. Cuts, you know, it may take them longer to heal. So we gave the cut a little bit longer. And then 12 weeks later, there's no a lot of callus, but if you can see here, there is bridging in that cortex, that one, and we thought that one also. So we decided to remove the fixator at 12 weeks. Unfortunately, 3 weeks later, the cut fractured the bone again through the previous fracture. So obviously that healing was not enough for the fixator to be removed. And in this case, we went in, we revised the fracture, and we applied a plate and screws internal fixation. And then finally, to finish, I'm going to talk about soft tissue impalement or soft tissue related complications with external skeletal fixator. So the soft tissues that might be involved are neurovascular bundles or muscle. So it's very uncommon to have impalement of the neurovascular bundles, because when we place the pins or the KYs, they usually move away from the pin. But it's very important when we apply a pin that we make an incision in the soft tissues, and then with blunt dissection, with a mosquito, for example, we reach the bone, and then we start drilling the pin, well, with the drill bit first for the pre-drilling, and then the pin directly on the bone. And then in the other side, when the pin is coming out, usually these soft tissues, they get away from the pins. But it's very important to have a knowledge of the anatomy and know the safe corridors. There are some areas in the different bones that are low risk for having this type of complication, and other areas, mainly the central parts of the bone where there's more muscles and nerves, are the areas a little bit more conflictive. So if we are unlucky and we have one of these complications, we have injured one of the neurovascular bundles, we need to remove the implicated pin. If there's a lot of bleeding because we have damaged one of the vessels, sometimes if we apply a bandage for a couple of days and apply pressure, that hemorrhage stops. But if the bleeding continues, we may need to remove the pin that is that has injured that vessel. And then also the pins may cross a little bit of the muscles, and that's going to create, as I was saying before, more movement of the soft tissues around the pins, so excessive discharge, inflammation, and obviously if we are crossing big muscle bellies, that's going to affect the function of that muscle and the movement of that muscle, and it's going to affect the range of motion of the joint at the ends of those of that bone by decreasing. So very important to know the anatomy, to apply the pins not through big muscle bellies but in between muscles. If it's really impinging the muscle belly and decreasing significantly the range of motion of the joint, we may need to remove the pin. Very important to do physiotherapy and then control activity to decrease the movement of the soft tissues around the pins and then decrease the risk of having infections. And then, so to summarize, it's very important that we use an adequate surgical planning and technique. The postoperative management is also important to decrease the morbidity, which I was saying is quite high for external skeletal fixator, at least higher than with internal fixation. And usually the most common complications that we are going to encounter are pin tract infections, which is associated with pin loosening and fixator-related problems of breakage or bending of the pins. So these are a few papers that you may read if you want. These are a couple of papers from a few years ago now, so it's getting older now, but that's where they explain what the safe corridors are for the forelimbs and the hind limbs. And then if you have any questions, I will be happy to answer them.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Pilar for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.